Hi, Manny. This is Manny Getty. His family own the Lucerne area. These cabins that you see down there are owned by his family. They were started by Manny's folks. And they were supporters of the Holden Mine. I'll be talking about how they fit into the scheme of things relative to the mine. What I'm doing here is using the 1940 census to give us a slice into time about what this town and mine looked like, what the people did, what our houses looked like, what kind of jobs, how many people there were, the value of the homes, and we'll get into a little bit more of that. One of the things I want to know is everybody knows where Winston is and what it was all about. Anybody not know about Winston?
I don't know what we were.
Have you been up there?
I just went to the closer tip to it, but I haven't been around.
Okay, but you know that was the family camp. That's where the primary families were living.
Okay.
And I'll get into more detail as long as I just want to lay out the land so people know what I'm talking about. When I say Winston, we know what I'm talking about.
Right.
Does anybody not know Honeymoon Heights, what that was? Okay. Honeymoon Heights, are you familiar kind of with the layout up where the main workings are, where the men are working up above, where the rock piles are? And if you face that mountain up there, Honeymoon Heights is basically the old original miners' camp. And it's uphill to the west, or to your right, at the base of those very large orange piles that are kind of conical. And you'll see some pictures of them. There's a small plateau up there. Mr. Holden made his original discovery high up on the mountain on the left shoulder. And he had his miner's camp eventually where those conical orange-looking waste piles are. And when the company came in for the final development, and I'm talking Howe Sound Company, they built larger buildings, a bunkhouse, cookhouse, their offices, engineering, but we're all up on that little plateau. When the town site, and we call this the town site down here, which is the staff housing, all of the dormitories, hospital, recreation center is what we called it then, rec hall. When that got built and completed in 1938-1939 timeframe, the larger buildings up in Honeymoon Heights were dismantled. The materials were then used to make single family homes. And most of those people there were very young, newly married, hence Honeymoon Heights. So, in addition, many of the workers' families were in Lucerne. And down there, I'll give you more detail on that too, but the cabins that you see down there were built by the Getty family, and many of the workers were living down there also. And there was another section also called Lee's Camp, which was next to it, slightly down lake, on Forest Service permit land. And that would surprise me is how many people actually lived down there at the time. I was very, very surprised. So we'll see some of that. Get the thing to start. So this is what it looked about 1950 something. In the current road going up to the base of the mill, this was the mill. It's just a skeleton up there. The shops, office building here, the dry, and which is the change room for the workers coming out of the main portal. And I was talking about Honeymoon Heights. It's up in that area, approximately there. And then this is a look down to the valley, so we know what we're talking about. Here's the tailings ponds that they're talking about now with the mitigation process. the town site, the circle. This is Winston Camp right here, and a newer section over here. They were just clearing. Unfortunately, whoops. This didn't come out very well. I apologize for that. Some of the things that are very interesting in the 1940 census, because the country was still trying to come out of the Great Depression, and the federal government was trying to gather a lot of new information about how their federal programs were working. And one of the things they were looking at, and I didn't analyze this, is where people lived in 1935, 5 years prior. What I was interested in is looking over here, although you can't read it very well, obviously, is the value of the homes. And one of the things that was very important up here so people did not take advantage of everybody is the home could be sold to the next person for only what that person paid for it and what they put into it for modifications. So I'm assuming here that in this valuation, this is what people paid out of their pocket to build their homes at that time. And then there are salaries, total salaries, and wages that people were paid for the entire 1939. So I wanted to take a look to see what the average wages were here and how that might compare to the outside world. How were we doing? I didn't do too much there, but I have kind of a comparative point. So that was kind of the starter thing to give us, how did this place really look? This is Honeymoon Heights. These are the long buildings, the original offices, engineering, bunkhouses. These were this construction. And if anybody's gone up to the other end of Winston, almost to the ballpark, there are actually a few homes that were built there early on, but taken down or moved into the regular part of Winston. You will also know, like dots, I think these were tents. And when my folks first came up here, when my dad came out of college, they spent their honeymoon in a tent in the ballpark area for the summer. And what a way to start.
Can you see the aerial tram from there?
Let's see, I don't think, yes, there's one of the supports right there, Bob, I believe.
Okay.
There was an aerial tram and here's a bridge. I believe this was the original bridge. The bridges were the truck bridges now and the footbridge that was all put in later. The main access was up in this area and the tram started on this side of the creek, as I remember. And this is what the place was converted to and looked like with the single family homes. That's Honeymoon Heights. And my dad left me in a snowbank again. Hey, Pop. That's me, I think. And that's our home. And contrary to the way Winston was built, which was very, very good construction, and the outside was highly controlled by the Forest Service, how they had to be looking, and the paint schemes, which are dull red, dull green, dull brown, as long as you selected those, were fine. A lot of these were tar paper on the outside, but they were pretty substantial homes. And as I'm looking into the census record, our home was valued at $1,500, which I thought was rather high for the time, particularly compared to the other homes in the valley. There was another home, I don't have a photo of it, it would have been in behind ours to the west, was valued at $2,500 up in this area. It really surprised me. And I don't know why. I mean, I don't have the information, obviously. Now we look at Winston. Winston, first, after the first blocks were built, consisted of 82 homes. And then 48 to 50, another 19 were added for a total of 101 homes in 1950. And that was the maximum number of homes that we had. This was the middle row. I don't know if any of you have walked up partway up the hill and then made an immediate left. This is it, right here. That is the road you're looking at. And it doesn't look like that today, does it? It's a little rock. Rather rough. And this was our school teacher's house here, I believe.
Yeah, you see the fireplace.
But we had three rows of houses. This back side of the middle row, and look at this guy right here. It's a pretty fancy home, some of these. They're very, very well built. And the people who sat up here got a terrific view. Anybody standing on the road, you get a wonderful view down there.
What year was that one taken?
Don't know what year exactly it was. It was probably, I'd be just guessing. I don't know for sure.
Whose house was that?
The corner, this was the corner house, and the road comes up this way, up that way, and this will be the first house on the middle road right here.
That one, Holden House.
That's Holden House, yeah. This is one of the more wonderful houses I can like to show because I love the architecture on this one. This was actually built by the family of my first grade teacher, the Bowie house. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is the top row, and this was around 1952-54 in that time frame. Like somebody pointed out, we have TV antennas. We actually did have TV in this valley by having a repeater up on the rock dump or on the tailings. I don't remember what it was for sure. But we had a pretty good shot along in this valley right into Spokane. And we got channel 4, KXLY, out of Spokane. Very snowy. In the wintertime, it was horrible. But that was the last few years. This house was located at the very top of that road that comes up from the truck bridge, and you take that through that underbrush past the middle road all the way to the top. And that was a long ways to carry groceries in the wintertime, but that's what Mrs. Kahn, who lived there, had to do in the wintertime. And this is what it looks like, obviously, in the winter. Somebody's climbed a tree, and there you are. And this up valley up that way. There is another stretch of houses on the other side of these trees as well. So it gives you a pretty good idea what everything looks like. The town site, this is a composite that was done by Larry Penberthy. He was a gentleman who came here and worked in, from 1941. He climbed a tree, took two pictures, and put them together. You can see the line right there. We got a tree right in the middle. Obviously isn't there right now. And pretty much what it looks like today. And shot in the dormitories, all Celotex walls, but these are the same dormitory rooms as we stay in today. We had a nice radio. We could get radio reception up here, sometimes not very good. I bought a Hallicraft's radio when I was about 12 years old from my paper route, and I would get San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah. And I listened to it at night with my earphones, when I wasn't supposed to. This is a shot of Lucerne, and that's what it looked like back in about 1940. This is the house that we lived in 1938 when I showed you my house up at Honeymoon Heights. My folks lived in a tent. We lived in Lucerne in this house. We lived in Honeymoon Heights. And that That's another one of the ladies, Mrs. Riggs, who lived in the Gettys, one of the Gettys houses. Okay, here we go. Little numbers. Honeymoon Heights, we had 15 homes up there at that time. The maximum number of homes we had up there, I think, was about 21. So it kind of depended upon how people moved in and out. People took houses down, rebuilt houses, put houses together. At this point, Winston only had 45 of the 82 that would make up the first block of houses that were built. What I found very interesting, Manny, is that your father had 41 houses for the miners. I was surprised that there were that many. And Lee's camp next door had 18, so that's a total of almost 60 houses housing the families, most of whom were workers. A few people helping Oscar and a few people helping the Lees to maintain the area down there.
How did they get to work?
They had a shift bus. And generally it was somebody down at the center who had the contracts to do that. And I believe they must have run only day shifts when they did that. I don't remember any buses coming through in the evening.
They used to run every shift.
Did they run every shift?
Yeah.
All the time?
Best I can remember.
Yeah.
There would be 6:30 to 2:30 shift at night. There were only a couple on that, and they gave me a pickup to drive back and forth, and then I had one passenger with me, so there were only two of us on that shift. That was the development, underground development crew.
Okay, thank you.
Was there a school there?
There was a school at Lucerne. They had a teacher. In fact, Manny's mother was one of the teachers. Honeymoon Heights was quite a range of housing, 500 to 2,500 for an average of over 1,000. If I took the 2,500 out, it was just about the same as the 900. But this really surprised me, given those houses with tar paper on the outside would be equal to all those in Winston. They're much better looking houses in Winston. In Lucerne, of course, when their rental was indicated as $15 per month, so there was no value given on the cabins in that particular case.
Bill, how did that, or Lucerne folk, how did that different camps get named Gettysburg and...
Gettysburg?
Yeah. No, I know what they are, but why?
Well, you'll have to ask Manny why. I mean, it's Getty.
What was that question?
The question is, how did your folks...
Yeah, Alice and Pat Lee had the, what became later, they named later the Lucerne Resort. And Alice and Pat Lee sold the property to Leonard Renslow. It went through a series of owners until the last one that had it was Holden Village. And for some reason, the Forest Service didn't renew the lease of Holden Village. And in about 1981 or 82, instructed them to clear the property so that everything was torn down. And my wife here didn't make it up there until 83, and she can't remember any buildings there at all. I think there might have been a couple of woodsheds or something that were still there in 83.
Thank you.
With
Getty, who owned it? Getty.
Yeah, our property was fee simple. Where the Forest Service property was on a year-to-year lease.
So that's one of the man trains taking the, it looks like they're getting off, coming off the shift. And we looked at movies over in the recreation hall, depending on time period, two times or three times a week, full-length feature movies with objection room is up the walls. We had New Year's Eve dances, brought in bands from Chelan, playing up here on the stage. My masquerade ball thing went up, man. Yeah, I guess I didn't put it
in. Tell them how they covered the floor.
Oh, well, we'll okay.
I see one. That floor doesn't look covered, actually. I was looking at that. It does here.
The floor is covered here. Well, on the Village Center, what we call the rec hall or recreation hall, we never, ever, ever wore our street shoes on the bare floor. There was always a canvas covering the floor and the chairs placed on top of it. The canvas was rolled up, put underneath the stage on carts, as were the chairs as well. And
the dances were the exception.
You can see now there's a bare floor, of course, for the dances. And what people would do in the wintertime, of course, you'd be wearing galoshes and outside shoes, and you bring your dance shoes in with you, and you change shoes before you step on the floor. And they shot us kids if we did anything otherwise. Total population. Now, I want to point out something that's rather peculiar as to what I've done. I've put the Lucerne one in parentheses because I don't include them in the total here. The total for the population is these numbers here. But the employees include all, so this gives us the distribution. We have 171 people in 1940 living in Lucerne. Manny, what do you think about that number? Did you think you had that many people? I didn't. I was rather amazed.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. At one time, there were 42 families living on our property.
Yeah.
I think it might have been a couple of them in tents.
Yeah. So the total population is 583 at that time, and that's pretty much close to the average. We averaged probably a little over 600 people through all the years. And I think it was somewhere around 1950, which was the peak when I looked at some of the company documentation. We had something a little bit over 700, and I don't know where they stacked them all.
I think they were kids. When you look at the enrollment figures for the school,
there
were
a lot of
kids,
but there are a lot more families, too. Yeah. And see, with Winston, what was that, 45 houses, 172 people. Mm-hmm. We employed 460 people. 54 of them came from Lucerne. And the dormitories, of course, that's the big population. And you figure, would it be about 52 people per dormitory, I think. This was the children count at that time, and the way I counted that, I think, was under age 16, just as a break point. So that gives you an idea of the cross-section of the, of our town. Honeymoon Heights, our average age was 28, so we kind of expected it to be young, maybe a little bit younger than that, but it certainly was the youngest. The town site, of course, here is, we're talking the circle and the management, we expect that to be higher. And the dorms were reasonably young. The oldest in Honeymoon Heights was 38, Winston 59. Dormitories of a couple of guys around 63. And town site rather high, and Lucerne was surprisingly high. I found one entry was 74. I couldn't make anything out of that, and so I excluded that. If anybody were to look at it and say, oh, Bill Phillips lied. I don't know what to do with that number because it seems kind of abnormal. So I kind of shoved it aside. The interesting part was this, because the country was coming out of a depression, still trying to make it, the unemployed was 54 out of this whole population. And that was a pretty large number, I thought. I don't know how that compared to other areas.
So that means they were unemployed in 39? But they weren't unemployed when they took the count, were they?
You were unemployed in 1939.
Oh.
That's where you pull it out of that column.
Was the census done in January that year?
Excuse me?
Was the census done in, what month was the census done
April,
in?
April 1st.
Oh, okay. And how many of the 54 were women?
Oh, I'm glad you raised that question. We'll come across that. None.
Okay, so
I'll answer the question even more completely, going ahead of myself. There were only two women employees. Mm-hmm. One of them was the nurse, who was the doctor's wife. The other one was the dental assistant. Those were the only two female employees at that time.
So there were no waitresses at that time?
No. There were waiters. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'll show some of that. We'll talk about that some more.
Were the unemployed concentrated in any one area?
Yes, I think most of them were Muckers, as I remember. So, what were the jobs there? And how many were in each job? And what I did here is tally up in the areas where there were the most jobs or the most interesting. I did not try to make everything add up to the total number of employees. I was running out of room anyway. So, so we have the drillers. And by the way, these are all, I think, pretty much Larry Penberthy's photos. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, he really did a great documentation. And the nippers, who were the drillers' helpers, making sure that the bits got to where they were, the ones that had been used went out and got resharpened and retempered. And the blasters and dynamiters. And the muckers shoveling up all the rubble into the ore car riding behind them. Eventually they even built up here a mucking machine operating off of compressed air to do some of that. And men working around the grizzly, and some men noted their jobs as grizzly. And what a grizzly is this grate. They were about 18 to 24 inches apart. Up above is a chute. The ore rock would come down this chute onto the grate. And the purpose of the grate was to make sure that the rock was no more than a certain size. If they didn't meet that and they got hung up, I don't show it, then they have to be blasted to make them smaller. And then it would be about a 100-foot chute down below that grizzly that would go into another rock chute then to load into the ore cars. And that was a very, very dangerous job, as you can imagine, because we did lose some people down some of those grizzlies. I think there were
several in that book are listed as grizzly fatalities.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You had to be very, very careful around them. And I was working on the bits, and we had to have motormen to run what they called the motor, or might call a locomotive, to haul the ore out. Man inspecting the ore, what he's doing here, this is an electromagnet to pick up any steel. If there are any broken bits, they've got to get that out before it goes into the crusher. Pull out any wood coming from deterioration or blasting of the timbers that accidental. This is in the top of the mill. There are men who manned these ball crushers. And this was the flotation process that was used to separate the copper ore, so there are people manning the flotation area. I want to talk about a little bit about this gentleman. His name is Vistuslav Zanadvorov, if I got his first name correct. He's very interesting in that he was a metallurgist. He got his degree in metallurgy in Russia. And he got caught up in the Bolshevik Revolution. and he made his way on foot across Siberia. And I wish I had all the details. His daughter Bonnie gave us a real good rundown several years ago, and I'm trying to find the audio tape on that. He eventually got over to Alaska and made his way down to the other mine that Howe Sound owned in north of Vancouver, Britannia Beach. And he was employed there, and then this property was actually opened up by Britannia Mining Company, which was owned by Howe Sound Company. And see, he eventually then became the mill superintendent here, and he changed his name to Victor Sandin. And then there was a really wonderful job of day laborer out working on the tailings piles. And those tailings piles out there were actually put in by hand. And what they were doing with these various outfalls on the, there's the pipe that ran around the periphery of the tailings pile. And the heavy stuff from the tailings, after the concentrated ore is taken out, these guys would have to build a dike all the way around the edge of the tailings. And then the water, there's the outfall right there. I'm just trying to find it. And then that would contain all the water on the center of the tailings pile. And we have a reminiscence from one young man who came up here one year in between college years, and he said this is the worst job he had ever had. And can you imagine being out there on that tailings in the middle of the summer, where it's probably 80, 90 degrees, shoveling this crud around? And they have to have ore truck drivers. And people in the machine shop building equipment. Warehousemen. By the way, this is Mr. Kahn. I talked about Mrs. Kahn, who was up in that house way up in the corner. So, underground, we had 78 people listed as miners, 69 muckers shoveling, 15 men manning the Grizzlies, 22 drillers, and 19 helpers. I was surprised there were only two people listed their job as a power man or blaster. There were hoists underground, at this time primarily for the man caves. Five people were selected to be motormen, and I don't know what the brakeman did. That one was new to me. The timberman would be the person who was putting it in the wood timbers, kind of like a carpenter. In the mill, the ore handler, I assume it is the guy at the head of the mill, but you can read these just as well as I can. One of the things I ran across listing, and my wife said I should list it, and I chose not to. One guy listed his name, listed his job as flunky. I said maybe he was really kidding. Well, I don't think he was. This afternoon, I was looking through a newspaper, Wenatchee Daily World, April 1939, and that's when the union and the company were negotiating wages. And doggone, here was a job classification, earning $4.25 for the day, hotel flunky, and surface common laborer. That was the classification. So that blew my mind away. So apparently it was a valid classification. Then I found another one. This was my school teacher's family, the Bowies, and Forrest Bowie, the father, was a metallurgist, essayist, and of course his wife is a school teacher, and their son was 19. He was, his job description is rock superintendent. So I'm trying to figure out what in the places is going on here, because his wage it was listed for 1939, all of 1939 is 2,500. Mm-hmm. And that's among the top wages. Between the three of them, they pulled down for 1939, $9,400 between the three of them. Where most everybody else was basically 2,500 or less, except for the manager, and that was the mine manager, and the other gentleman was he was listed as an accountant, but I know that he was the purchasing agent and office manager, and their wages were listed as 5,000 plus. And I think Mr. Bowie's was at 4,500, which I found kind of interesting. That's for the year. The other interesting thing, Manny, is your father was listed as for wages for 1939, $9,100. That sounded like a really good wage for the time. All the however he did all that.
That was probably the gross business revenue.
I don't know how to read that.
I think that was self-reported.
No.
How many shifts did the mine have?
We had three shifts.
Three shifts.
Yeah, it was a 24-hour operation. And I heard that it was 24-hour operation 7 days a week very early on, but I don't have the information. That was, you know, obviously I was too young to know anything about that. When I was cognizant, we did have that many shifts, but not everything was operating full speed on the weekends. They did have weekends off. And as I remember, the weekend started with the end of night shift on Friday night. And then Sunday started the graveyard at midnight. So it was midnight Friday night to midnight Sunday night. There was a minimal number of people working. And obviously, I think they kept the mill running. I was trying to remember if the pressure still went during the weekend.
I don't know. And before my dad left, they hauled the ore out. They were working 3 days a week, 12-hour shifts. So they weren't hauling out every day.
Oh, okay.
It was when things were starting to slow down. That would have been in 55.
Mm-hmm. Did they have a church or any pastors or anybody taking care of the spiritual needs?
No, we did have a pastor at times. There was a gentleman who was working up here for the mine, and he substituted as a minister. We did have Protestant Sunday school basically every Sunday, and a Catholic pastor came up once a month, as I recall.
There was an Episcopalian minister coming up in the 40s from Wenatchee,
yeah.
And then we had Morgan in the 50s, and some of the Sunday school, both 40s and 50s, I've done some research on this, some of the mothers did Sunday schools, and of course the services were in the village center, like, you know, our gym was like your village center, that's where we had everything. So that's where the services were. And then I do recall in the 50s there would be a Catholic priest would come in periodically, and a few Catholic families would usually have something in one of their homes.
And down at the bottom, let's see, 16 people, this is their jobs as a blacksmith. I assume that must have included the welders as well. That seemed like a fairly large number working with steel and so forth. But anyway, there you get the kind of general idea. Then we come to the office workers. This is a shot inside the office. Accountants, timekeepers, and so forth. See Eddie Haddon.
Mm.
But Mr. Haddon was a long-time person up here. He started as an accountant, and then he eventually was the office manager. But he did a lot of stuff up here. He was president of the community club for many years. He was president of the school board very, very involved in community affairs up there.
Which where were the offices?
Where were the offices? They were up, when we were talking earlier about the long rock pile on the top of the mill. In that area where the there was a electrical yard where the electrical wire transmission wires came in. The there was a standby diesel plant up there. There was a compressor room where it was supplied the compressed air into the mill and also throughout the mine for the drilling. There was a machine shop, there was a welding shop, there was a two-story building, the only two-story building above the mill, which was a warehouse on the bottom, general offices, engineering office, and manager office on the second floor. And then there was another machine shop next to the portal where the drills were brought in. Then there was also on that level, you know, what we called the dry, where you can see the concrete structure over to the west end of the rock pile up there, fairly large. And that was the basement of the change house. So when the men came out, because it was a wet mine, they had to change their clothes. And so they put on the street clothes, left their mining clothes inside with their boots on a basket, and the poles were hung, and then hoisted up to the ceiling, and heat was supplied all year round, so the men had dry clothes when they came into shift the next day.
Weren't the Haddons the family that shipped the piano down, because they were in Premier, British Columbia, weren't they first?
Yeah, they were in, they came down from Stewart.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know that story, I don't remember. So we had dining hall workers. We had a doctor, and this is the photographer playing like a patient. And this was our revered doctor. He was up here several years. He went to the Army, came back to Chelan. He was probably one of the most revered doctors in the Chelan Valley, Dr. Wong. This was our famous dentist. At that time, it was difficult for me to determine if he was here continuously, but he listed this place as his home, not Chelan.
Mm. Yeah.
We had a barber. Of course, we had a school teacher, and this is our beloved school teacher, Mrs. Field, who lived to be 105. Amazing, amazing woman. We had a wonderful experience with her teaching up here. So we had a chef, three cooks, nine waiters, and these were all men, people handling the vegetables, meat cutters. Always had somebody to make the lunches for the men to go underground or wherever they were going, dishwashers. The fountain lunch, or a snack bar, we had five people who were employed for that. These, again, were all men. In the recreation area, I don't know what these recreation people were specifically were doing, but we had five pin setters. I thought that was good.
You can still make money doing that if you know who to ask.
Well, that's right. I mean, you've got to have recreation. You've got to be pulling out the going. I thought that was interesting that we actually employed people.
I thought it was just extra work that they did. At least it was that way in the 50s.
That's what 50s. You and I talked about, but there it is. My job is pin setter.
Interesting.
So I'm taking it verbatim. And it's the same thing, motion picture operator. You would have thought this would be an extra job. But it was
in the 50s.
It was a concession in the 50s, but that one family had done it for most
Rogers.
Of it. Rogers, and he had a regular job, didn't he?
Yeah, he was a hoistman.
Yeah.
Yeah. But see, things change.
Yeah.
You know, you can ask a person a question and get an answer over here. Ask this person over here and get another answer and another one over here. Depending on what time frame you're talking about, all the answers are correct. Things change. And what I want to also point out here is kind of emphasize, because it's probably the climb of the times and the fact that we wanted to make sure men were employed. This was before the breakout of World War II, which changed things considerably, particularly for, well, the company I worked for, which was Boeing. Later on, there were women employed, particularly in the fountain lunch. Men and some others worked in the fountain lunch. I know Patty Haddon, we were talking about Ed Haddon, his youngest daughter, Patty, was a waitress. Do you know what names of other people who were
several waitress? Of the Rogers women worked as
in the dining hall.
Yeah, they worked as a lot of the women worked in the, in yeah. fact, in the '50s, almost all of it was all women working in the dining hall, waitresses. Yeah.
So
they actually had a separate union classification for those women. They made very good wages, higher than women would make for those jobs on the outside.
This was definitely a union town, and the company, there was a very strong union. I can't remember the full name of it, but they were under the umbrella of the CIO. One of the things that was going into the future from here is that as the kids got older, it became very evident, particularly among the boys getting through the teenage years, you need to employ them. Mm-hmm. So the company did provide summer jobs for us, but they were all surface jobs. We could not be in the carpenter shop, we could not go underground, we could not be in the mill, could not be around any rotating machinery. So I worked, for example, two summers when I was 16 and 17. And there weren't as many jobs available for the girls, but they did try to do that because some of the girls did work in the dining hall and the fountain lunch for summer jobs. So the company tried to do that. And an interesting note, because I talked a little bit about the union, which is very, very strong. I was in a peculiar situation. This is a very, very small community. Everybody knows everybody. The managers worked very, very closely with the men underground. My father was on the company negotiating team, which put me in a very ticklish position because I had a union classification job and I had to join the union. That was a requirement. So my dad pulled me away and he says, "You're not to ask any questions. I'm going to tell you what the dig is. You're to go down to the union meeting. You're to go through the initiation process, get the stamp for your book, and then you are to come home. That's it. No questions. Don't tell anybody. Don't talk about it. This is it. This is the sermon." And of course, one can understand where that might be.
Well, that was one of the issues. The women, the wives of the managers, could not work in any union position. So, like, if your dad had been management, your mother couldn't have worked in the fountain lunch.
And you know, when you mention that, I think about it. Most of the women that worked in the mess hall and that worked from Winston.
Yeah.
They were all from Winston.
And most, well, I was going to say most of the school teachers, but that's not true. But Harriet Wilbur's husband was management, so she taught school.
Right.
And there were no other women in the circle who worked. I mean, there was a nurse, but there wasn't another woman in the circle who worked. Marge Haddon, Patty's older sister, worked in the office for some period after college when she was saving money to go to Europe.
That's him. But in the office.
But in the office.
And it was kind of interesting in my situation because I don't know of anyone else. It was the manager's son, for example. He worked in the summer. But I don't know if he was restricted by his father the same way that my father restricted me. There was another fellow I grew up with that lived next door to us up at the top of the circle. And I know he worked three summers up here. His father was the mine foreman. That was a considered a management job, non-union, and I asked him about this whole situation, and he went to the union meeting. So, it was kind of interesting.
Any idea who took care of the post office?
Excuse me?
Any idea who took care of the post office?
Well, the name of the man who took care of the post office for most of the years that Linda and I were partners, it was a fellow by the name of Al Holzhauser, and he was employed by the federal government.
And there's a certificate of his appointment as postmaster. It's an official thing signed by the president. It's in the museum. And there were one or two women that worked in the post office, and I think they were federal employees also.
He was, probably the only non-company person that I can think of who had a house up here.
What about Fredberg Weaver? Was he non-company?
Not officially. He was
initially, Fred Wigbers was a fellow who was an employee who worked underground, and there was an accident underground, and he went blind. And what the company then, after that, allowed him to run kind of a general sundry store right where the bookstore is today. Mm-hmm. And he sold, sometimes toothpaste, toothbrushes, there's cosmetic stuff like that, fishing lures, magazines.
Hunting supplies,
fishing supplies.
Just a supplement store
that we eventually had. But he was totally blind. And the postmaster that we were talking about, because the post office was in there also, that was when you walk into the bookstore, the first thing you walked into right there was the post office with the postal boxes. And then over to the right was Mr. Wigbers' area. And so when orders came in, the postmaster would help, Mr. Holzhauser would help Mr. Wigbers put the items on the shelves and place them for him. And he'd just tell Mr. Wigbers where stuff was. So he'd go in and say, hello, Fred. He'd say, hi, Bill. Or anybody else. Say, hi, Linda. He had very, very acute sense of hearing. Man, he could find anything. So he just didn't help him because he didn't want to be, of course. And he was able to find everything off the shelves by feel. But I thought it was real great that the company would do that and let him stay here. Mm-hmm.
The other employees that were not working for House Sam, they contracted the grocery store, but the people who worked in the grocery store actually worked for the company that had the contract for the grocery store. They worked for Chrysler.
Yeah, that's true. Good call.
There was an account of having a policeman sometime during this process.
Yeah, we did. We had a constable. His name was Miles Sims. He was appointed by the county. And I'm not sure what the arrangements were with his salaries at the time. I never talked to the family about that. Because I would assume part of his salary was paid by the county. He was also the fire chief up here, and he manned the entire fire system, kept it going, kept it checked out, and that kind of thing, and that job would have been paid by the company. So I'm not sure how that got apportioned. I have no idea.
I don't either. He was appointed later, he was fire chief before he was ever, I forget what year the constable came, late 40s or something that he was appointed, but I'm sure he got some compensation for it too, but his primary job was fire chief. We didn't have a lot of issues up here because if anybody started getting in trouble, they were gone anyway.
And one of his other jobs also is, I remember, because this is another area that's kind of sensitive with us kids. He also would maintain the ballpark, so we had a drag to smooth out the ball field area for a softball game. And you go lay out the chalk lines. Well, boys being boys, we'd love to go up there and play baseball. So we scuff up the chalk lines. We'd go out there and put footprints on this newly drafted out in the field. So we found out that was the thing.
Was there a forester up here?
Was there a...
like a forest ranger or somebody from the...
No, there was not a forest ranger stationed up here. During the summertime, the guard station down at Lucerne was manned.
Oh, okay.
And that's kind of an interesting thing from my personal family point of view. Oftentimes that was manned by a college student and a senior man. And there was one summer, for example, there was a young man came out here from Alabama. And he worked up in Stehekin, met the Courtneys and all that kind of jazz. And then he ended up manning the guard station, or helping in the guard station. He had no family. And finally, we went down for a picnic, and we kind of befriended him. So every time in the summertime, we'd invite him to our family picnics on the lakeshore. And this summer, we visited him in Alabama. So his friendship has been going through the family for a long time. Okay. I think that's the end. Yeah. There they are.
Wow.
That's the end. The question was asked about shift bosses, and the shift bosses were unionized.
So what was in the space we're in right now? Is this?
This was a full-fledged dormitory right here. This was dormitory number 5. This area was taken out, but this was all rooms just like number 4. The dormitory was kind of a very sensitive area, as you can imagine. So all the dormitories were single rooms. Except later on, number 3 was converted to couples' apartments. And the rule was that no women were allowed at all in the dormitory. And that was subject to dismissal. There was no leeway at all. Even more importantly, children were not allowed ever in the dormitories or around them or to play around them, with one exception. That was for us kids to deliver newspapers along the doors, but that was the only exception. There was generally no fraternization, but I'm going to tell on my brother because he's not here. This is older brother talking.
We spend most of the summer.
Number 4, I was noticing today some people were working in the number 4 basement. And I can remember my mother wondering, what the devil is John? I said, oh, he's probably up at the other end playing with Nigel Adams or somebody like that. I got no clue. We didn't find out until years later that what he was doing was going to the basement, meeting a couple of men who were very reputable men, by the way, very good workers, and he was learning to play piano. Folks are trying to figure out how to tell him how to be such a good player. Well, the end result of that was there was a gentleman who was actually a fairly good friend of my father, decided to go someplace else to look for greener grass, as it were. He had this canoe. These guys, 2 guys, had found this canoe. It turned out to be an old town canoe, for those of you who know anything about canoes. Swamped down on the shore of the lake. And they couldn't find out any owner of it. So they brought the canoe up here, and they put it into the basement of number 4, and started working on it. So in exchange for my brother learning how to play pinochle, he worked on the canoe with them. If it was had to be refurbished. So the men used the canoe. And then this gentleman decided he was going to leave, and he gave the canoe to my brother, which was really, really a nice gift. And then he came back. And John says, I'm going to give you back my canoe. He says, no, it's yours. I gave it to you. I wasn't expecting to come back. It is yours. And he still has the canoe. It was in 1942. And we use it up in Donkey Lake.
That's worth a lot.
And he, yes. And he was the master of the canoe, my younger brother. So he was in the rear. And he made the decisions as to where we were going to fish. Except my parents said, we're going to go here, and you guys are going to go there. And we don't want to hear you.
Were most of these buildings that we see here in the village From 1940.
These were built in 1937,
1938. And the chalet is also up there?
Yes.
Except number two, it was replaced the burned one.
Right.
Yeah.
Number two, you know, number one is the manager's house starting from the bottom. What he was talking about is next door. Number for us, it was called the guest house. And that was the house where Mr. Sharp, as I knew at the time, who was the president of House Sound. That was his place to come when he visited us here. And then number three was what we called the staff house. Mm-hmm. And that's where the men who worked in the office as accountants, there was a geologist, fellow that I knew a long, long time, taught me skiing. And a couple other gentlemen, I don't remember at the time, but they were single men rather than being in the regular dormitory. Working in the office, they worked in the staff house. And then there was a hierarchical assignment of the staff houses all the way up around the circle. Number four was the mill superintendent. Number five was the mechanic and electrical superintendent. Number six was the office manager. Number seven was the mine superintendent. Number eight was a geologist. Number nine was the mine foreman. Number 10 was the chief engineer, or number 11, those were two engineers. Number 12 was an accountant. Number 13 was an accountant. And number 14, I never knew for sure if he was the mill foreman or mill safety engineer, but one of those mill managers.
Is that where we keep the cooks today, in 14?
I don't know.
We used to, anyway.
No.
And like, as he mentioned, things change. There's actually, and I think it's in one of the books in the museum, there's a chart that one of the women put together that titles changed over the years. Who was in what house, especially when the doctor had four kids came because he needed a house. He couldn't live in the apartment, the hospital. But the other thing is that if they got a promotion, they might would move downhill.
Was there a lot of accidents or deaths?
What do you want to do?
I've been working on this, trying to document them all. I have 17 names, is all I have as far as fatalities, industrial fatalities, and then I have community deaths also. And again, if you're interested, there is a little book in the museum that has them listed, and the ones that we know what happened, I have that information. But trying to find records to government agencies has been very difficult. And I've still done some work on it, but I only have to 17 names. We also had babies born up here. They're in the book. And I have 14 fully documented babies born and three more names that I'm trying to get the information on.
It doesn't seem like a very large number to me when there was such a dangerous occupation.
They had really emphasized safety. If the picture of the porthole had the safety first sign over the entire time it was operation, and they really emphasized it. And people, if they were injured in an accident, it was their fault. They were probably fired anyway. So, yeah, they really worked on safety. It was a dangerous occupation.
Yeah, and there was, in addition to the safety signs at the portal, that I can remember also a billboard on the other side of the footbridge where the men are working now. There was a billboard there, safety first kind of thing. So it was a real emphasis.
There was one over the drive, too.
Yes. So it was considered pretty well run with that low an accident rate emphasis on it. And they had safety engineers in both underground. These were engineers who were assigned specifically for safety in both the underground and in the mill. And there was also another engineer who was assigned strictly to take care of the ventilation system. There's another shaft to the west of the main portal, and that's where there's a huge, huge fan drawing the air out and making sure the air is not stagnant inside. And there was an engineer assigned to specifically take care of that entire ventilation system because there had to be basically draft doors inside the mine. You want to have a turnover of air, but you don't want to have a wind tunnel going through either, particularly in the wintertime, drawing a lot of cold air. I don't know all the details of that. It's kind of top level. But there was a real heavy emphasis on those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Were any of these folks subject to the draft during World War II?
No, the underground people were protected from the draft, and so were the engineers. Mm-hmm. The people on the surface were subject to draft. I'll tell you a story. I got to tell my story. There was one of the things that's very interesting. I couldn't figure out in the census, just as a sidelight. There were in the 1940 time frame. There were two men living as hermits on Dumpty Lake. Gordon Stewart, some of you may have heard of. And there was a man before him, Mr. Cool, Albert Cool. And Albert Cool went there first. He homesteaded there. There's a gentleman who still owns the property up there on Donkey Lake where people can fly in and stay in cabins. But they had a trapper line. And Mr. Gordon Stewart learned from Mr.
Cool.
How to run the trapper line. When Mr. Cool died, Gordon got all the cabins and property. Well, a very interesting thing was that Gordon was drafted, and the engineers were not. And there were a lot of people who went up there fishing, and he had rowboats up there at the time. Later on, he had motors on, but rowboats. So some of the gentlemen opposed. They proposed to Mr. Stewart that they would take care of his rowboats while he was gone in the army. And he said, and they would rent them out, collect the money, save it for him, put it in a bank. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. So he hung all his boats up in the trees up at Donkey Lake. Well, people still wanted to fish, so various people built their own rowboats and then took them up to Donkey Lake. So when he came back, all these people had these rowboats up there, and he was not very happy about that. And so he always had it in kind of for the engineers. Mm-hmm. So anyway, years later, and I knew him kind of. I took my Boy Scout troop from Indiat Valley up over Emerald Pass down at Donkey Lake, and talking to a pastor from here. I said, how's the fishing? He was out in one of Gordon's rowboats. He said, it was really great. How much did he charge you? And it was $5. Oh, heck, that's not much. So I went over and talked to Gordon and said, hi, you remember me? And he charged me $10.
You talked about your paper route.
Yes.
Where were the papers published and how current were they?
They weren't too current. There were two newspapers, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which was quite late, and the other one was the Spokane Spokesman Review. And Spokesman Review, primary subscribers were at Winston and the Seattle PI, primarily down here. And I delivered the PI along with my brother down here. And I don't know who delivered the paper at the other end. But they had to come from Seattle. They came overnight bus, as I remember. So they had probably, well, maybe the afternoon edition, the day before coming out of Seattle. Well, it wasn't too bad.
Nigel did the PI in the 50s, and Jim was doing the Spokesman Review before they finished it.
Yeah.
We who are guests have heard various stories about the decibel level here. Was it just in routine living? Was it loud? Continual?
Yes, it pretty much was continual. There was continual noise from the mill. The mill was really quite noisy. There were pretty, very large crushers. One of the crushers, they eventually, this was the jaw crusher, they eventually moved it down into the lower level, so the mine was a little bit quieter. It was pretty noisy. And you could also always hear the fan. It was awfully, awfully quiet when they turned the fan on, but it was fairly noisy as well. And it basically, if you go up to the ballpark, if you're facing the mountain there, be just slightly off to the left. So it kind of blew toward the ballpark as well, so it could be quite noisy. And there were people, I believe, in Stehekin who claimed that they could hear the mountain. That's some of the stories. Pretty bad
echoing
around.
So, I saw looking by the track, she just didn't really notice it that much after, you know, as a kid here, doing things you weren't really worried about. I always tell people when I'm talking that my recollection of listening to the fan would be similar to playing in Winston Camp, would be similar if you walk right by our hydro today. When you hear that hum, when you go by the hydro, somewhat of a similar level as far as the loudness of the hum. If you're standing right by the hydro, it's fairly loud. But you noticed it more if it stopped. You didn't notice it when it was running. You only noticed if it stopped because it got deadly quiet.
So it was 7 days a week? Yeah. It was 7 days a week?
It was running whenever the shifts were running, yeah.
And that would be 7 days a week?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if they ran it on the weekends as much in later years, because like you said early on, they had some 7 day. And I don't know when they stopped doing blasting on the weekends. They did some blasting. But if there were men in the mine, it would be running.
Because oftentimes what they do is they did the blasting on Sunday morning when nobody was around. So they would do all the drilling during the week, of course, and lay their charges. And then you want to get everybody out of the mine. And of course, Sunday morning is the most quiet and all. When they lit up, and you could hear it, plenty of it. There was a time when looking at the memoirs of one guy. This was a 2,000-ton processing mill, 2,000 tons per day. They at one time were trying to blast enough rock for 2 weeks of continuous operation in the mill. And that was a lot of rock that they had to blast. I don't remember all the numbers. I would sit down and kind of figure them out. And a lot of powder. A lot of the operations changed, you know, from one area to another area. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Wow,
wow. One of the things that was very interesting that Chuck Carpenter asked me. He came up here, back up here the same day on Wednesday when we were coming up. And we got to talking about the traffic control and so forth as we were escorted up the switchbacks. He says, how did the ore trucks figure out their timing and traffic control? And I don't know. It's a good question. I've often wondered about that myself. And we had three ore trucks. At one time there were obviously four from that photograph, but I only remember three running later years anyway. And I don't know how many round trips they made each, and maybe three, but I'm not sure. I was just running some oddball numbers, given the amount of rock they're processing and the amount of ore they got to get out of here and how they were loading it. So I don't know if that's the right number or not. But on the switchbacks, there can only be one truck coming down or one truck coming up because there aren't any turnouts. There weren't any turnouts then. So how did they work then? I really don't know, except it maybe was by timing. I don't know.
They didn't go together, they went just separate.
I don't remember them going as a pack. No.
Is there a sewer lagoon type thing somewhere up there too?
We didn't have a lagoon as such that I know of. I'm going on pretty much on what my first job was uncovering the cesspools. We did not really have a septic system. And these were holding tanks. There were factors one up and behind the manager's house at that time anyway, and uphill from that. And what we had to do was...
How long are you going to be here?
Up here.
Uncover the guff that they put on the top of the concrete lids. So pull the concrete lids off, come in with a pumper and pump them up into a tank. And my understanding at the time when I was asking the other guys, because I couldn't go with them, is that they hauled the tank and emptied it up on the top of the tailings. That's what I understood at the time. There was no other holding pond. Now, before I worked those things, I can remember when I was in grade school over here, that a couple of us would walk away from the school to the east in the big trees back there, and there was a sewage holding pond back there. And maybe that was just from the early years and just temporary. I have no idea. And in fact, I've never found anybody since the mine closed that knew anything about it. I was telling the people here about that, and they couldn't find it. As I understand, they could not find evidence of it back then. So apparently it all decomposed into regular dust. I don't know. But that's what I remember. We used to throw rocks in it.
Oh, it wasn't open. It was open.
It was an open pit, yeah. It had just been scraped out with a caterpillar.
That's where the drain field, the septic tank and everything was when we came here. It was behind Narnia, back in toward the woods over on the left side.
Yeah.
And that's where it was, and the guys all had to go back there and muck the stuff out of there all the time to keep it working.
Yeah. But we had, there was another tank in the dormitory someplace feeding the staff housing. I only remember the one tank up here in behind the manager's house and chalet too. But of course, I think the one is still existing on the west end of the hotel. Isn't there still one there?
I thought, inside?
Outside, on the slope. And it was a grease trap as well, and it was absolutely awful. And then there was another tank that I remember because I almost fell into the doggone thing on the lower road of Winston, just across the road from that single row of houses.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember where the rest of them were. I had just completely blank. I don't know how many there were.
Well, they just. Dealt with the one that was inside under the store, what, a year, two ago?
That was the grease trap?
No, it was a heating oil tank. What was it?
Heating oil.
Heating oil. And that was quite a little goodie. They put stuff in it and worked it so the air came out at the same time. They fill it full of something. Foam? Sand? Yeah, so that it won't collapse.
The grease trap up here was horrible because they had to open, I think we had to open that up every year to
clean it
out.
Yeah. Well, that's why they have us scrape the plates the way we do. Because we don't, there's one there now. It's got two lids. That's to keep us from being in trouble down there and out there.
Yeah.
And we learned because we put in that thing at Winston Camp, and then we just clogged it up totally. The drain field was just like, and it was awful to walk up there. So I know what you're talking about, how bad it can smell.
Yeah. Well, this isn't good country for a drain field.
No, it isn't. It's not at all.
Well, I need to leave tomorrow morning. This is wonderful.
That's great.
Thank you very much. One question. This is sort of a personal question. How do you feel when you come back here? It's really coming home, and it's remarkable that the buildings are still here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I suspect that would be a pretty good feeling. But
it is.
Yeah.
It is, because this is my only home.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it's always great back.
Well, you're here till what, you're about 18
or 19? I'm one of the very few fortunate people, because there are really not very many in my side of the community who come back. Because I feel very lucky that the houses that I live in are still standing.
Huh.
And even though we lived in every housing area here, so I was trying to indicate, you know, my folks were in the tent, so they even were, the Cerns were,
Honeymoon
Heights, and we were in Winston.
And then you met, yeah.
But, you know, it's got to be a different feeling for the people who come up here, and all they have to look is a foundation. Mm-hmm. And I can look at a physical house, and it's a lot different feeling. Mm-hmm. So it's always, and I've been trying to get some of my other friends to come up who were down here, but they don't come back up for some reason. I don't know why. But it's a great feeling to come back.
Yeah, good. Well, you did this well. Thank you very much. Appreciate
you.
Go ahead, Rick. I have some new questions regarding the picture, so I'm sure Rick has some questions for you.
But there's tailings one.
Right.
And there's tailings two. Right. And I think three may be just starting. This is a very, very early picture, actually. And I don't think all of the 101 houses are in here yet.
Okay. This is Honeymoon Heights.
Yes.
And the ventilation is somewhere here.
I would guess so, but that's why I'm thinking if it's there, then the ball field has to be here.
And that has to be the ball field.
Yeah, it can't be much further than that.
But I'm thinking, you know, what in the world is this?
Well, I think what this...
Because that's now in the wilderness area.
That's right, and that's some... I was trying to remember how that looked, because that's on the creek.
Well, isn't this the creek here?
The creek coming through there. I don't know. I've looked at that myself, and I've wondered, and I haven't really fully satisfied myself as to what it is.
Right. I have some other questions, but I'm sure Rick does too.
Oh, it was great. I can...
So go ahead.
Okay. Well, in some of the photographs that I've scanned, I've seen a photograph of the recreation hall being constructed.
Mm-hmm.
I've also seen a photograph where it looks, I'm not certain of this, but it looks, based on the angle and stuff, and where the trees are, that the rec hall, Lodge 5, and Lodge 6 were not constructed. But the other buildings, the dining hall, Lodge 1,
yeah.
Chalets are constructed.
Yeah, you're basically talking three buildings on this side of the road, and those were the last ones to be constructed.
They were.
It was a two-stage process. So the first year, this side was constructed, and then the second year, the other side was. And they went through a redesign. If you look, there are some maps in the archives here which show the rec hall actually oriented 90 degrees from this one. So in the intervening period, it appeared to have changed the design and what they wanted to do. But it is true, it was a two-stage construction.
Okay. Were the chalets numbered back then?
Yes, they were.
Yep. Is it the same numbering as we have now?
Yes. And the same thing for the lodges and dormitories, they're one for one numbering.
The reason I ask that is one of the people that was here is Don Wilson, and mm-hmm. he gave a presentation maybe more than a week ago now on the 1940 census, and he could only see chalets 1 through 12. He never saw anything for chalet 13 or 14. That's why I was asking the question about the numbering.
Oh, in the 1940 census?
Yeah.
I added them up, and you've got to be a little careful how you do it. And the reason is that not the one page of the town site is not complete. There is a page 61A, and you have to know how to read it. And the only reason I know how to read it is because I don't know the names of the people.
Sure. Sure.
So it makes it a lot different for me. But this is it.
Hang on a minute. I need the glasses.
Just to give you an idea.
Thank you.
Okay, this is house number 43. So you have to go back to Winston to put those guys in. And that was, I can't remember which family they were with. Number 70, these guys, number 70 is the dormitories. That was the number assigned for the dormitory society members. So those three gentlemen were in the dormitory. There's a 70 if we go to, do I see the 70 there?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a 70 there also.
Right.
So that tells you these guys are dormitory. This 71, I don't know why they call it 71, but it's not the circle or the staff housing. This name doesn't fit with any of our diagrams, so I assume they're Winston. It's a family. Mm-hmm. Ray Olson, I'm not sure. He's got a 44. I'm not sure why. Okay, now 72. 72, that's the mine manager, Mr. Curzon.
Okay.
He was in number one. Number 70 is dormitory. Dewar is a dentist. And the others are dormitory. Now, I assume because they were living together, they were probably housed in the hotel. That's my guess. There was a time when that was, I kind of misspoke because there. I think there was a time when there were mixed sexes in the hotel, but they could have been in the guest house. I don't know. Yeah. They don't know how to count. Adams, of course, I know where they are. They're in Winston. Because I know these people.
Of course.
And 70, and here again, these two would be in the dormitory. Harold Smith, I know he's an engineer, and he was probably living in number 10. In fact, I think he was the first engineer to live in number 10. That is our number on the charts.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have here's Mr. Cool and Mr. Stewart. And they're just trappers. Well, I know they didn't live up here. I know that they lived at Donkey. Why they were included in here rather than the Stehekin precinct, which is where Lucerne is, I have the biggest idea why they put them in here. It seems weird.
Huh.
And 77, let's see, I think, I'm not sure what I did with them. But anyway, so there are two families here, Curzon and Smith, who are in the staff housing. That's probably the two that he's missing. That would make.
Interesting.
I'm not sure I did all the total correlation, but it kind of looked that way. I kind of eyeballed it that way. And I'm not sure if he got 14. I didn't really check it that closely.
No, that's fine.
But that can make the difference in trying to read this overflow chart.
Sure, sure. When my parents and I first came up here in 1965, we were housed in Chalet 14. We were told that that was called the Doctor's Chalet.
No, the Doctor's Chalet was 11.
11?
11.
Okay.
And it's have you touched base with Larry Howard? And he quit. We were looking at it today in one of the boxes. You know, one of the boxes up in the loft. There is a diagram of the staff housing.
Okay.
And as I remember looking at, Dr. Mickens was shown on there, and as I recall, he was listed as living in number 11.
Okay.
So that kind of changed, even though that was an engineer's house.
Yeah. I'm just relating what I was told at the time.
I don't know.
I do my work for Larry, so I talked to him.
I don't recall of any doctor living in 14. In fact, what Linda and I were trying to remember is whether the doctors I lived in 11 or 12. And I had to look on the chart and said, well, Mickens I know lived in 11. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember who followed him, but we'd have to look at that again. But it was either one or the other.
Sure.
Anyway, that's, it's just a small point anyway, but whatever.
So, interesting, you never set foot inside the mine?
I did.
You did?
I didn't talk about it. I was scared to hell. No, I did. I did not work in the mine. You know, I worked when I was, like I said, when I was summers, I was 16 and 17. The final year, my senior year in high school, when I turned 18, I brought a friend up during spring vacation, and my dad took us underground. And that's the only time I ever went under. And then we left that spring when I graduated from high school. Base of the mill, that was the guy I reported to. And he sent me on an errand over to the carpenter shop, and I could go to the front steps of the carpenter shop, but I could not go in. And then we had very explicit orders for anything like that. And I was never given a job running into the mill or anything around any kind of machinery. And this was true for all of us. Mm-hmm. We were looking for summer jobs. We had to be 18, 30.
Sure.
In fact, there was one summer that, well, the summer that I was 17, we were actually working up on the Holden Lake Trail with a geologist. And he was running a series of experiments where we were running, we had to brush out lines diagonal off the Holden Lake Trail, uphill and downhill, all the way down to the dumb brush with machetes, clearing it out. So, and the geologist and his intern helper were running electrical lines with the ends leading into a pot of electrolyte, basically doing what's, see if I can remember this correctly, determining any anomalies in the geomagnetic lines on the Earth's surface.
Oh, okay.
And if you find any disturbances, then there could possibly be an ore body underneath, and that was one way of trying to determine if it was one. And they got a new brushing machine with a rotating disc on it, like a remote, a hand saw or a power saw, with a big long handle and rotating, rather than a line trimmer that you use today, and to cut the brush. And they trained us. And if we were very, very careful and handled it properly, they allowed us to run it, but it was probably not legal to do that, because we weren't really supposed to run power tools either.
Interesting.
I couldn't even. Well, I was going around, and we had men who were gardeners, basically, among other things, during the summer, so they were mowing the lawns around the dormitories and so forth and that kind of thing. I couldn't even run a hand pusher mower machine. I could do a hand clipper and trim all the grass around the concrete and all things like that, but I could not run a lawnmower. Yet I had to mow family lawn. But that's how strict it was.
Interesting.
And they watched it very, very carefully. On the other hand, though, I think about what we did. I don't know if you've seen the Penberthy's photos of the old company dock from up above. And if you're looking up lake, you've got the company dock with the traveling crane on the top of it. And over on the left side of it is a boatway. And the purpose of that was to haul the tug on an inclined rampway in skeleton structure to work on the tugboat and work on the hull and that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
So we used that partially also for pulling the barges out of the water, but they were too heavy to pull all the way out, but mainly because you kept water inside in order to keep the wood swollen so we don't have leaks. So they'd pull it up part way and try to tip it, let the water run down the other way. And we'd be inside in this incline thing, sloshing around water, tamping oakum in between the planks, and then spreading cuprinol all over the inside, and there's no ventilation. So feature that one.
Yeah, that goes over a while, I'm sure.
That wasn't one of the nicer jobs. But it was, you know, but it was, they've been over backwards to give us jobs, though. They had to do that for teenage boys. And that was trying to keep that going. One of the other jobs I had wasn't too bad a job, but several of us did this. We'd hold the road grader down. And they'd grade the right-hand half into the middle, come back up the road and grade the other side, the slope side, into the middle. And then third pass down and spread it out. And then I'd follow with a pitchfork, throwing the rocks over the side. And even that you had to be careful of, because I had to walk about a quarter mile behind the grader, because it has this huge diesel engine on the back, a tremendous noise. And if an ore truck ever came up behind me and they move and they're not going to stop, if you don't hear them because of the noise, and you step out, it can be a problem. So they watch that very, very carefully. So.